Welcome to The Wicket.
Hello, and it's time for another episode of your favourite cricketing chat from Arab News here at The Wicket. I'm Brian Murgatroyd, and with me as ever to assess the latest happenings in the sport locally in the Gulf, regionally in Asia and worldwide, Arab News columnist John Pike and Arab News cricket reporter Subhash Hamagain. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Brian. Hello, Subhash.
Hi, Brian. Hi, John.
And in this episode, we chat about week two of the Indian Premier League. We talk about four women's international series going on at the moment. That's Bangladesh against Australia, England in New Zealand, Sri Lanka touring South Africa, and Zimbabwe hosting Papua New Guinea. We start our build-up to the Asian Cricket Council's Premier Cup, where 10 of the region's top associate sides, including Saudi Arabia, will be battling for places in next year's Asia Cup. We discuss the fallout and implications of Pakistan's decision to reappoint Babar Azam as the country's white ball captain at the expense of Shaheen Shah Afridi. We look ahead to the start of the county championship in the UK, and Subhash and John give us their personal highlights from the past week. So, as ever, lots to get our teeth into. As we record this podcast, the second week of the Indian Premier League is almost complete and the 10-team table is starting to take shape. The Rajasthan Royals have been impressive under Sanju Samson, securing wins from each of their first three matches, including one in Mumbai at the expense of the Mumbai Indians, who, under new captain Hardik Pandya, have lost their first three games. Just behind the Royals are a pack of teams, including the Kolkata Knight Riders, Gujarat Titans, Chennai Super Kings, and Lucknow Super Giants, with CSK's first loss coming at the hands of the Delhi Capitals. That was the Capitals' first success of the season and featured a half-century from Rishabh Pant, his first since returning from injury, plus a cameo in a losing cause from MS Dhoni in his first innings of the 2024 season. John, let's reflect then on what we've seen so far, and particularly the past week, and what a mess at Mumbai, with spectators booing Hardik, fans calling for Rohit Sharma's return as captain, and most importantly of all, results going badly wrong. Who's to blame for this situation? Is it Hardik for accepting the role of captain, or the management for giving it to him?
Oh, both parties would have made the decision in good faith. It was a surprise. Hardik must have had his reasons. I don't think you can blame him for the decision. At present, it's looking like a misjudgment by management. To be fair, Subhash did spot this before the tournament, referring to potential disharmony, and this seems to be the case.
Well, Subhash, you were spot on there in your prediction. And is the answer here for the Mumbai management to swallow their pride, admit a mistake and give the captaincy back to Rohit? Or would that create further divisions and upset Hardik, who Mumbai need firing in order to get their season back on track?
Well, it's a big dilemma. I think the fans want Rohit back, but in ideal world, I think Rohit would not want the thing back, because if he takes it back, I think it's just going to make the situation worse. Hardik as a player is one of the best, and Indian all-rounder, fast bowling all-rounder is hard to find already. So I think Rohit is kind enough to let the situation stroll, and maybe if they get one or two results, one or two win on the trot, and I think everything will fall back into place. Change of captaincy would create another havoc inside the squad.
Well, John, one of Mumbai's losses was a remarkable one to the Sunrisers Hyderabad, who pummeled them for 277 for three, a record IPL score, and Hardik's tactics of keeping Jasprit Bumrah back during the early onslaught drew fierce criticism. Is that his fault, or does the team think tank need to step forward and shoulder some blame too?
They should be working in harmony, but harmony doesn't seem to be occurring with the MI. The captain also should have the discretion to reassess and amend preset plans if the anticipated situation does not materialise. I think the fans' criticism will only inflame an already fragile situation, and their behaviour has already been rebuked by the franchise.
Well, Subhash, you were very much in favour of the Sunrisers bringing in Travis Head, and they did so to very good effect in that match. Their batting actually looks terrifying, but Do they have the bowling depth, control, and wicket-taking ability to sustain a title challenge on the evidence so far?
Well, I think their pace attack was reliant on Bhuvneshwar Kumar, who has not impressed as much as expected. But the batting looks excellent. The players are in form, and the bowling needs to step up. I think this could be Sunrisers' year, and Bhuvneshwar Kumar especially should step up. Mayank Markande is doing pretty well on his front, but it's up to the seniors to lead the bowling attack or expect someone to come in. I think Marco Jansen is a good option, but I think as the expense of batting, I don't think it would be ideal to play him at this time. So I think Indian bowlers should step up now.
Well, John, Delhi needed that win. They really did over CSK, and Rishabh Pant needed those runs too. Can you see positive possibilities for the Capitals off the back of that win, or are they still lacking in certain areas?
Was to give them heart, and the top order worked. The real damage was done by Kahil Ahmed, a forgotten man who dismissed Ravindra and Gaikwad in the first two overs. I think there's a worry there for Norte, who was expensive, 43 off four overs, and was really rescued by Mukesh Kumar's 3 for 21.
Subhash, although CSK lost that match to Delhi, there still seems a positive spin about the defeat from their perspective, thanks to MS Dhoni's innings of 37 not out from 16 balls. It really was like he'd never been away, wasn't it?
The last over same day he was on form, but I had expected him to fire a bit much earlier. I think once he started firing, the match was already done. So I think Dhoni's form looks good for CSK at the moment.
And John, what have you made of Rajasthan's unbeaten start? Riyan Parag's back-to-back 50s have taken the headlines, but they look a well-balanced side, don't they? With Bolt and Berger attacking up front, the two left-armers, then R. Ashwin and Chahal posing a threat with spin. They look a useful outfit, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Again, hats off to Subhash, who spotted the promise. It's any team with Sangakkara as director has a chance. And the trade of Devdutt Padikkal to facilitate Parag's role in middle order has worked so far. Yes, they have a balanced attack. I think at the moment the top order is inconsistent. Jaiswal's not continued his recent form. And Jos Buttle seems to have completely lost confidence. I mean, you'd think they're surely too good to fail for too long.
Yes, if those two get going, then watch out opposition sides. But Sebash, just reflecting on your main takeaways from the past week, which teams and players are struggling and which have clicked in your opinion? I guess we have to talk a little bit about Lucknow Super Giants, don't we?
Yeah, I think Mayank Yadav is an exciting prospect. His speed and his control on the bowling, I think that's been talk of the town. He's only played two matches, but we've seen even after the first match, Brett Lee, Dale Steyn, the pioneers of fast bowling, have been vocal about him. And I think looking at him in this second match, especially, he looks like one exciting prospect. And Bumrah should be happy. He's got someone to partner with. I think it's early days, but the potential he has and the performance he has shown, I think India should be smiling now. And along with that, I think Bangalore would be a bit unhappy on how they've spent in the auction and not getting back in the results. I think Virat Kohli has been the only limelight in that team. And if they want to come up in the points table, I think their batting and bowling both should fire now.
Yes, of course, the one thing we have to remember is with the IPL, it's a marathon, not a sprint. So there's still a long, long way to go. We'll keep on top of all the goings on in India, and we'll be back with another chat on the subject in our next episode. Australia's women look set to head into a break in very high spirits after a triumphant tour of Bangladesh. With one 2020 international still to play as we record this podcast, Australia have followed up a 3-0 series win in a one-day international series that forms part of the ICC Women's Championship, with a series win in a three-match 2020 international series as well. We covered that one-day international series in our previous episode as Bangladesh were bowled out for 95, 97 and 89, and that sort of dominance has continued for Australia in the T20Is. In match one, Bangladesh scored a respectable 126 for four, thanks to captain Nigar Sultana's unbeaten 63 from 64 balls. But that score was put into perspective by Alyssa Healy and Beth Mooney, who knocked off the required runs in 13 overs for a 10-wicket win. In the second match, Bangladesh left armour Fariha Trishna took a hat trick in the last three balls of Australia's innings, her second in the format after doing so against Malaysia in 2022. But the damage had already been done by that stage, with Georgia Wareham striking 57 from only 30 balls. Australia won that match comfortably by 58 runs. John, aside from playing in a country where they haven't been for more than a decade, what have Australia actually achieved, do you think, by this visit? Given the gulf between the two sides, it could be argued there's not a lot of purpose to this trip, or is there another way of looking at it?
I think there is. The old adage, poor planning leads to poor performance, comes to mind. I would think that they've learned a lot about local conditions on and off the field after not being there for so long. And also, they've laid down a marker, I think, for the World Cup.
Yes, of course, it's worth remembering that the World Cup is going to take place, the T20 World Cup in Bangladesh at the back end of this year. So it's been certainly useful work from Australia in that perspective. Subhash, Bangladesh are the hosts for that upcoming T20 World Cup, as we've mentioned. Should they be worried by the results from this tour or realistic about where they stand ahead of that mega event? Can you see any positives for them?
Yeah, I'd say matches like these prepare them for what is to come. I think Australia are the best team on paper and on field at the moment, and these results will help them to take on these type of teams. Well, the World Cup pressure will definitely be different, but Bangladesh should pick themselves up and try to react to the moments they had, and I think that will only make them stronger going forward.
Incidentally, the second test between Bangladesh and Sri Lanka's men is ongoing as we record this podcast, and we'll have a review of that match in our next episode. England's women are going nicely on their white ball tour of New Zealand. They won the T20i series 4-1 and arguably should have won it 5-0, but missed out thanks to a horrendous collapse in match three. Then in the first of three one-day internationals, they won by 4 wickets as Amy Jones with an unbeaten 92 from 83 balls and Charlie Dean, who finished not out on 42, added 130 for the seventh wicket after the side had slipped to 79 for six, chasing 208. John, what a fantastic innings that was by Amy Jones, who spoke afterwards about playing each ball rather than thinking too far ahead. It was an approach that obviously worked for her, wasn't it?
Yes, I've long thought that she's not realised her full potential with the bat. And perhaps a crisis situation such as this, with time to build an innings, is the base on which to develop that potential.
Yes, very impressive stuff from Amy Jones. But Sebash, if you were New Zealand, currently in fifth spot in the ICC Women's Championship, would you be looking over your shoulder at the possibility of Bangladesh or Sri Lanka leapfrogging you for an automatic spot in the 2025 50-over World Cup? Or would you still be confident that there's no chance of missing out on a top six place?
Well, if you look at the fixtures, I think Sri Lanka are yet to play West Indies at home, and Ireland away are comparatively easier fixtures. New Zealand will play Australia and India after England. So Bangladesh too have Ireland and West Indies. So I think the fixtures help Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. So it was already a tough prospect for New Zealand before the series began. And if you look back, the two rain-affected matches against Bangladesh in December 2022, I think that could prove a very costly one for New Zealand. So I think it's not going well if you look at the paper, but New Zealand need to fire now.
A reminder then that the ICC Women's Championship has 10 teams battling for six spots in that ICC Women's Cricket World Cup in India next year, with the four sides below the line facing the prospect of playing in the qualifier. As we record this episode, the order is Australia top of the shop, as is often the case, South Africa, England, Pakistan, New Zealand, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, West Indies, and Ireland. India will qualify automatically as hosts and have also played fewer matches than any other team, while the West Indies do have matches in hand on those sides above them. We'll wrap up the one-day international series between New Zealand and England's women in our next episode. Sri Lanka's women are in action in South Africa in 2020 internationals and one-day internationals ahead of the side's trip to the UAE for the ICC T20 World Cup Global Qualifier. The first match of the tour saw the visitors thumped by 79 runs as South Africa's captain Laura Vollvaart hit her maiden 2020 international 100. But they learnt their lessons, did Sri Lanka, and won the second match by 7 wickets with 7 balls to spare as Vishmi Gunaratne and Kavisha Dilhari added 76 from 46 balls, chasing 138 for victory. Match three is taking place on the day of our recording. We'll wrap up that encounter together with the first one-day international of a three-match series in our next episode. But in the meantime, let's chat about what we've seen so far. Subhash, Chamari Attapattu has scored 1 and 6 in the first 2 2020 internationals. Is that a negative given so much is expected of her? Or do you see it as a huge plus that the side can win without a telling contribution from her?
I think the Sri Lankan team should take this as a positive. If you look at the stats, the last 8 matches that Sri Lanka won against the SEENA countries, Chamari had been the player of the match. So I think Kavisha coming in the forefront, chasing the total, I think this is a fantastic thing for Sri Lankan cricket. There's something beyond Chamari as well. Chamari herself would be under huge pressure to get some runs. But if you look in hindsight, I think this is a positive that other players are stepping up as well.
John, that 100 from Laura Vollvaart, 63 balls, 12 fours, 3 sixes. Is an innings like that an illustration that she's benefited from playing all around the world? She was part of the Adelaide Strikers side that won the WBBL before the turn of the year and has since been playing for the Gujarat Giants in the Women's Premier League in India.
She was an outstanding young player, so her talent has never been in doubt. She did hesitate over taking the captaincy to assess whether it would affect her batting. Seems the opposite effect might be true. Add that to the international exposure. I think you've got a potential superstar, still only 24.
Yes, that's certainly something to bear in mind that she's still a relative baby in the game, but what a tremendous innings that was from her. A reminder that Sri Lanka are involved in that T20 World Cup qualifier, which will be played at two venues in Abu Dhabi in the UAE, the Zayed Cricket Stadium, and also the next door Tolerance Oval, which staged the Afghanistan Island Test recently. The tournament is set to begin on April the 25th, with the final on May the 7th, with not only Sri Lanka, but also Ireland, the Netherlands, Scotland, Thailand, Uganda, the UAE, the USA, Vanuatu, and Zimbabwe taking part. Two sides will go forward to the T20 World Cup in Bangladesh. One side that won't be in the UAE for the Women's T20 World Cup qualifier is Papua New Guinea, but they're currently enjoying a historic tour of Zimbabwe, including their first one-day internationals since being awarded ODI status in 2022. They lost the 3 50-over matches they played against their hosts by 7 wickets, 2 wickets, and 35 runs, respectively, although they could and perhaps should have won those second and third matches. But then, after losing the first of 3 2020 internationals by 8 wickets, they bounced back to win the second match in a super over. That really was an incredible encounter, as they wanted 15 from the final over, scored 13 from the first 4 balls, then lost a wicket off the penultimate ball as they sought a winning second run before another run out brought the super over. PNG then scored 7 when they batted before a nerveless over from their own Sibona Jimmy restricted Zimbabwe to 6 and saw the visitors in raptures at that remarkable success. John, PNG's women lost out to Vanuatu in last September's East Asia Pacific qualifying event for the ICC T20 World Cup Global Qualifier that gets underway in less than 3 weeks in Abu Dhabi. And what a shame there weren't more berths for East Asia Pacific countries in that event, because on this evidence, cricket is really making progress as a women's sport in the region.
Yeah, you mentioned there are 10 teams in the tournament. Ireland and Sri Lanka qualified from the 2023 World Cup, Thailand and UAE from the Asia qualifiers, Uganda and Zimbabwe from the African qualifiers, Netherlands and Scotland from Europe, USA from Americas, Vanuatu from EAP. So on paper, solution is to increase the EAP in Americas to two teams, give a tournament of 12 on the assumption that that number of teams can be accommodated. It seems a fairly straightforward solution.
Well, let's see if the ICC go down that path for future events. Sebastian, from Zimbabwe's perspective, what is the significance of this tour? Will it dent the side's confidence ahead of that T20 World Cup qualifier, or has it given the side some hard cricket ahead of the challenges that lie beyond them?
That depends on how they take it. For me, the close finishes are beneficial to make you ready for these big matches. I think you need to be ready for the Norway end, and these close matches will make you prepared. And Zimbabwe need to look at the moments rather than the end result. And these moments, if you take it positively and reflect to it, I think that will make them stronger.
The Asian Cricket Council Premier Cup is coming up fast on the rails and will get underway in Oman on Friday, the 12th of April. It features 10 teams playing in 2020 internationals: Bahrain, Cambodia, Hong Kong, Kuwait, Malaysia, Nepal, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and the hosts. And the top side will go forward to next year's Asia Cup, which features the region's heavy hitters: Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. Eight of the sides in Oman are at this stage because of their positions in the ICC rankings, but Saudi Arabia and Cambodia won through to the ACC Premier Cup after finishing as the top two sides in the ACC Men's Challenger Cup in Thailand in February, a tournament we covered in depth here at The Wicket. Oman are already gearing up for the Premier Cup by hosting Namibia in a T20i series, with both of those sides also set to go to the Caribbean and the USA later this year for the ICC Men's T20 World Cup. Namibia won the first of five matches by four wickets in a low-scoring thriller, as the experienced David Visser and Dylan Leitcher saw them home with an unbroken stand of 39 for the seventh wicket after they slipped to 75 for six, chasing 110. Oman had fallen in a heap, actually, from 74 for two, with more than 9 overs remaining, as Tangeni Lungameni captured 3 for 13, including a maiden. In game two, Oman bounced back, winning by 6 runs, defending 137 for seven, as Mehran Khan took 3 for 17, despite Herat Erasmus's 58. Sebash, Nepal and the UAE are the hot favourites, but as was the case in the T20 World Cup qualifier, they've again been drawn in different groups. If they end up topping those groups, then they'll avoid each other ahead of a potential final meeting. But we saw in that qualifier for the T20 World Cup that after Nepal finished as runners-up in their group and the UAE won theirs, it meant the crossover semi-final between them would see one miss out on the year's main event. What are your expectations this time?
I think the firm favorites are Oman as well, because they're in the same bracket as Nepal and UAE. They're playing at home and are preparing playing against the strongest opponent. Nepal are fine-tuning their squad in India, while I think UAE are still struggling for balance under the new coach. And UAE will have tougher challenge in group stages, so they'll need to set the tone from match one. I think overall, I think this is still Nepal's tournament to lose. They look in fantastic touch, and World Cup preparation couldn't be better than this.
Yes, just to confirm those groups, Group A features Hong Kong, Malaysia, Nepal, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. And Group B has Bahrain, Cambodia, Kuwait, Oman, the hosts, and the UAE. What a blockbuster that promises to be between those latter two sides in the group stages. John, Oman, of course, they'll have their own views on the favouritism of Nepal and the UAE, as Sebastian has just mentioned. And they impressed in that T20 World Cup qualifier in Nepal last November. They went unbeaten through it, in fact. Oman, very much a side to look out for here, you'd say.
Yes, for sure. They're on home territory, as Sebastian's mentioned. They'll want to make that count to prove a point. And currently, the ICC T20i rankings place the UAE at 16, Nepal at 17, and Oman at 18. So it's all very tight.
Sebastian, talk to us about Cambodia. They've come on quite a journey as well to get this far. They had to win through a qualifier to even reach the ACC Challenger Cup in the first place. Do you think they can spring any further surprises given they're now in perhaps the highest company they've ever competed at?
I think they're in for a reality check. They pitted in tougher group with teams used to playing in this condition in Oman, UAE, and Bahrain, Kuwait as well. So the sort of format gives them outside chance against the bigger teams, but I think you need to have quality to compete as well. They may fancy their chances against Bahrain, who look weaker of the other opponents, but I think they'll be need to add their best to compete against these big teams.
John, what are the prospects for Saudi Arabia? They were mightily impressive in that ACC Challenger Cup and fully deserved to win that tournament to earn their spot here. But then they came down to earth with a bump in the 50-over format when they missed out on progressing to qualification for the next ICC Cricket World Cup. Does this format give them the best chance of landing a few major blows, do you think?
Yes, it looks that way. They're ranked 31 in the T20I list, close behind Qatar, 28, Bahrain 27, Kuwait 26, and Malaysia 25. And in the group for this tournament, they're with Nepal, Hong Kong, Malaysia, and Qatar. And I think a measure of their progress is likely to be results against the last two.
And John, how important is it for cricket in Saudi for the team to be playing in a tournament like this?
Absolutely vital. They're part-time players who need every opportunity to be challenged in international tournaments of this kind. I think it's a really important step in their improvement and growth.
Well, there's plenty of detail about cricket in Saudi Arabia on the Arab News website. Just visit www.arabnews.com/cricket and you'll find all that detail there. In our next episode, we'll wrap up that Oman Namibia series and look ahead in further detail to the start of the ACC Premier Cup. Well, you know, we really could have a podcast dedicated solely to the goings-on in Pakistan cricket. Since our last episode, the worst-kept secret in cricket worldwide, let alone Pakistan, that Shaheen Shah Afridi was set to be relieved of the T20I captaincy has come to pass, and Babar Azam, who only a handful of months ago resigned from the leadership role in all formats, apparently reluctantly, is now back in charge. But even this decision wasn't straightforward, or at least announced in a straightforward fashion, as a statement put out by the Pakistan Cricket Board announcing the change included comments of support for Babar from Shaheen. However, it turned out that Shaheen neither said the words he was quoted as saying or even authorised them in his name. Subsequently, the PCB has posted on social media photos of Chairman Mohsin Naqvi visiting the side's conditioning camp in Abbottabad, and those images included a handshake with Shaheen. The post, along with a media release about the visit, went out on April Fool's Day, so we can leave it to listeners to make up their own mind about whether the cricket world is being pranked here. John, what a mess. In terms of how to handle a situation, this has to be textbook how not to do it.
And in the tangled world of Pakistan cricket, another in a long line of PR disasters, it does really seem to be part of the DNA. It really is very sad because we all know that a harmonised Pakistan team can challenge for top honours, and it's sad that the situation is so highly politicised.
Subhash, does Babar's swift return to the captaincy, albeit only the white ball leadership at this stage, as Shan Masood is still test captain, surprise you, especially after the way his time at the helm ended after the Cricket World Cup?
It took me by surprise when PCB announced his reinstatement. Like Shahid Afridi said, this one would have been a better option if they had to change the leadership anyways. I think the selection committee comprises of players who have played with current prop-up squad. But I think there's a huge challenge now to get the balance right, get the dressing room right. And it's just before the World Cup. I think the timing could not be any wrong.
John, in your opinion, does this move stabilize or destabilize matters?
It's a very fragile situation. Babar's captaincy was not a great success, nor was Shaheen's. I think Babar was obviously affected by losing the job, both personally and in his form. The same could happen to Shaheen, although I think his form has already dipped. Another example of change of administrators and selectors showing where their preferences lie. And the new PCB chair, Mohsin Naqvi, does not seem to have warmed to Shohei's captaincy. And remember, the Qualanders has only won 1 out of 10 in the PSL under his leadership. As ever, it's going to be a case of seeing how the players react in order to know if the situation has stabilised.
Yes, Sebas Şahin has been struggling for his best form ever since last year when he came back from a knee injury. Could this decision actually help him focus on his own game, or will it make him more disillusioned, do you think?
As I've been voicing since the appointment, I think this could be a blessing in disguise for Sahin personally. All he needs to do now is focus on his own bowling, what he does the best. We saw him coming up the order in PSL batting as well, something I felt he was putting himself under huge unnecessary pressure. I think he's a premier fast bowler and he should be continuing to do being so for Pakistan.
Well, whether this decision will now draw a line under a period of turbulence in Pakistan cricket remains to be seen. But rest assured, we'll keep an eye on things and report back to you with any further goings on here at The Wicket. Well, the Northern Hemisphere summer is definitely on the horizon as daylight saving has ended and the County Championship cranks back into life with an opening round of first-class matches across the two divisions. It's a world away from the helter-skelter of the T20 franchise leagues around the world, and with men's test cricket in the UK shunted to the second half of the summer because of the T20 World Cup in the USA and the Caribbean, the early rounds could find themselves starved of a great deal of the oxygen of publicity. The overseas players on show are no longer the gold standard of imports of the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, when there was still little international cricket around the world from May to August. But there's still something to raise some excitement. South Africa off-spinner Simon Harmer is back at Essex, where he's now within sight of 1,000 first-class wickets, and he's joined there by former South Africa Test captain Dean Elgar. There's also a substantial Australia contingent arriving with fast bowler Scott Boland joining newly promoted Durham. Manus Labuschagne is back at Glamorgan. Cameron Bancroft returns to Gloucestershire. And Matt Renshaw does likewise with Somerset. Also, in perhaps the biggest domestic switch of the off-season, Dan Lawrence has moved from Essex to County Champions Surrey. John, for all the romanticism and rich history of the first-class game in England and Wales, its detractors could say it's an analogue product in a digital age, watched largely by retired people, and something that, in comparison to the IPL, has little relevance to the modern game. Is that fair?
Other countries have their equivalents. Sheffield Shield and Ranji Trophy, for example, as breeding grounds for the longer format. In England and Wales, the historical structure is probably unwieldy, but there's an awful lot of sunk investment. However, a number of counties are in financial difficulty, and this is providing the detractors with extra ammunition. Three of the 18 counties are privately owned, whereas the others are membership-based, where members have the power to block change. And it's interesting to note that there is a movement underway by the detractors to take on this model, arguing that privatisation of the structure is necessary to facilitate injections of capital into the game. And a book is out this week which argues that case, and it's called The Fight to Keep English Cricket Alive. And we're set for a battle, I think, between the privatisers and their opponents, whom they regard as Luddites.
Yes, it's a subject that you've highlighted in the past year on this podcast, particularly in relation to Yorkshire County Cricket Club, John. And it was interesting to see Richard Gould over the past week talking about the possibility of private investment in the 100 too, the short form tournament in the UK. Is that the way things are going, in your opinion?
I think it's almost inevitable now. I think it's a question of the speed of the process.
Well, Sebastian, as someone not from the UK, does county cricket resonate with you at all?
To be honest, there's very little talk about the county in our circle. Only when an international recruit makes an impact, we see it in social media, especially the Indian recruit in the last few years, Sai Sudarshan playing there, Chetaswar Pujara, Ravi Ashwin at times. So it's not possible to follow a whole season with cricketers, solely domestic English cricketers playing. But we know how important it is for first-class cricket and how big of an impact it had in 80s or 90s, like you mentioned. But right now, I think the emergence of IPL and England being a bit far, that there's not much talk about that.
Well, I mentioned publicity for the early rounds of matches of the County Championship, and one reason for some publicity may well be that England Test captain Ben Stokes looks set to be making a few appearances for newly promoted Durham as the season cranks up, as he's ruled himself out of the T20 World Cup to concentrate on a return to full all-round fitness following knee surgery last year. That has to be good news for Ben Stokes, for Durham, and for county cricket in general, John, doesn't it?
Yes, it was a surprise that that he's taken that decision. He obviously knows his body better than anybody, and he's getting obviously some very sound advice. But it would be good for domestic cricket, but I think a disappointment for those who follow England.
Well, rest assured, we'll keep an eye on what's happening in the first class scene in the UK, and we'll update you here at the Wicket. And finally, gentlemen, as we always do, let's hear from you about something that's caught your attention this week in the world of cricket. John, first of all.
In one word, longevity. Start with MS Dhoni's little cameo, which we've already mentioned. There are players for whom I have utmost respect in the game, and he's one of them. And as you know, this week I'm at the Chiang Mai International Sixers Tournament, which is in its 34th year. First one was in 1988. It lost 3 years to the pandemic, but it's now back with 30 teams. One of which the Drifters I'm playing for, and I've managed to get in a few couple of overs so far, and that tells its own tale about longevity.
Well, that's good to hear, John, and we'll be looking forward perhaps to reading a little bit about it in a future column of yours, perhaps.
Yes, I'm going to focus on that this week. I'm going to look at his history, put it in the context of the game in Thailand, how it managed to take a hold in a place where no one would normally associate the game with. So you can read quite a lot more about that. And I'm talking to some of the people who organise the tournament and the sponsors to get their input.
And you can find that at arabnews.com/cricket. Sebash, what about you? What's caught your attention over the past week?
I think Nepal A formation has helped Nepali cricket in a big way. The backup team for the senior team that's been used in practice, and Kamal Singh Airy, who picked up an injury while playing for the national team 2 years back, is now paving his way, trying to be back to the senior team. And he's playing against the Ireland Wolves for Nepal A, and you never know, could be in the flight to US and Caribbean for the World Cup, all thanks to Nepal A and the preparatory series they're having against the Ireland Wolves.
Well, that's fantastic news that Nepal are developing a layer of players below the elite level, and yeah, that has to be encouraging for the development of the game in the country. Well, that's it for another episode of The Wicket. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back soon with more cricket chat from the Gulf region, Asia, and worldwide. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, and comment on what you've heard. Wherever you get your podcast, we'd love to hear your feedback and let us know if there's anything you'd like us to feature in future episodes. But for now, this is Brian Murgatroyd, along with John Pike and Sebash Humagain, saying thanks for listening, and we look forward to your company again next time.